Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Juvon Tai Doon Yi Soon Sin, Jorn Vestai Vampyr, and Jajim Tai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings, fellow warriors, and welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. And I have my co-hosts with me today. Say hello, gentlemen.
Hello, gentlemen.
Well, it's going to be one of those days, apparently. Jorn and Juvon.
One of those books.
Yeah, I'll say.
I'm Juvon.
Well, welcome, guys. And today we are going to be looking at Pawns and Symbols, a Star Trek original series novel number 26 by, I hope I'm saying this right, Mylis Larson. The publication on this date was November of 1985. And John, you want to give us a brief introduction on this book?
Well, it's not mentioned anywhere in the book. We just know that because of the characters and their interactions with each other, we know it has to take place after Day of the Dove, because we're going to run into both Kang and Mara, and their relationship has changed since Day of the Dove. The few Klingon words that are used in the book do not appear to be from Mark Okrand's Klingon dictionary, but they seem to be more of the ancient court Klingonese rather than the Klingon whole that he came up with. From the back of the book, we have this description. Threatened by a deadly famine, the Klingon Empire is on the verge of igniting a mad interplanetary war of conquest. When an earthquake destroys a remote Federation research station, Jean Chernay, agricultural scientist, succumbs to amnesia. Stranded on enemy borders, she is imprisoned by Kang, the evil commander of a Klingon battleship. Now Kirk must play a dangerous game of mind strategy to prevent a savage attack on the Federation.
Yeah, interesting wording there. And I'm sure we'll get into that in a few minutes and see some inconsistencies in the description and the way the book plays out.
It doesn't fit whatsoever.
It's like somebody was given a broad stroke explanation of it and then punched it up on top of that.
Yeah, it definitely does not seem to be written by the author, the blurb on the back of the book. So, Juvon, why don't you give us your overall impressions of this book?
I did not like this book. I wouldn't say it's the worst one we've reviewed so far. I'd still give that one to How Much for Just the Planet. But it's definitely down there. And I feel it does fall into a lot of the issues that Time Trap has, is that there's a lot of interesting ideas that they don't really pursue.
Okay, and John?
This is one of those books that I have to say kept putting me to sleep as I was trying to read it. I could get maybe 10 pages in it and find myself drifting away. I think the main problem with this book is the nature of a Mary Sue novel. Now, are any of you guys familiar with what a Mary Sue story is?
Yeah, I think we've talked about that before.
Mary Sue, in this context, is Jean, and it seems like she's getting from just one crisis to another and falls into relationships with person after person after person. Well, maybe just person after person, and that's how she gets out of them. There was the incident with the Romulans that we're going to talk about later that didn't even seem to fit within the plot structure of this particular story. It seemed to be, oh, this book is not long enough. Could you throw an extra chapter in?
Yeah, I would have to agree with both of you. This book just, for me, did not seem to have a direction. It kept going and swerving back and forth in and out of the story. And the characters, the Enterprise characters were pretty good, but the Klingon characters were weird. I will be the first to admit that I am used to Next Generation and Deep Space Nine Klingons, and that's what Klingon is to me. But talk about Mary Sue. Kang was just, I don't know. He was, wasn't very Kang-like.
I think a big problem with this book is the title, Pons and Symbol. And what do you think you're going to sink your teeth into? You're going to sink your teeth into a plot that is very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Chess master
style. Yeah, very driven, very logical. This is definitely not that.
Pawns and Symbols would have made a great name for the Final Reflection, because that was a lot of maneuvering pieces throughout the guy's entire life. He treated everything like a chess game, or I forgot the name of the game in the book.
Klingza.
This one, Klingza. And this book, besides a few references in like the first couple chapters, they kind of drop it towards the end, and I don't even get the symbol part. I just only get the pawn part.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's why I say the title of the book throws you off for what you're later going to see. This almost to me seemed to be a romance novel, not a Star Trek novel.
And not a good romance novel either. Like, I've been fine if it's a romance novel. It's just it's not even good at what it's trying to be.
Okay, well, let's start tearing this thing apart, and we'll look at characters first. Let's start with the Enterprise characters. Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Scotty, Sulu, Chekhov, and Uhura all appear here.
I was just going to say, I think they're all written very... the characters themselves seem like the characters from the show, and when they're on screen, I think they did a good job of writing them, but anytime they popped up, it felt like this person had written a book that mainly focused on somebody else, and they came back and said, oh, you have to have some chapters with the Enterprise crew. So he injected like these random chapters, like they're on the whole planet side part, and the Romulan excursion was fairly random, but the Enterprise crew, I felt they all felt in character.
There is a new species is introduced in sickbay. I can't pronounce the name of the species, but they were a telepathic, telekinetic, you know, mind-powered species that were doing medical things to the Enterprise crew, for the Enterprise crew, with McCoy's supervision. And that's about the only introduced character that we see other than the ones that we know about from Trek. I will say it was Dr. Chapel again, not Nurse Chapel.
Which is a bit confusing, because I thought we kind of established within the timeline that she probably became a doctor closer to the motion picture. Where this one, they're clearly in the old uniforms. This is clearly before Kirk becomes an admiral. So this does skew the timeline we seem to have with her becoming a doctor.
And I think you're clearly correct on that point.
I thought the characters on the Enterprise were done quite well. However, I thought myself, it was like, well, where are they? I mean, we had chapters and chapters of Kang trying to put the moves on Cherney, or not try to put the moves on Cherney, or whichever way it was going. And then we'd get this little blurb of the Enterprise doing a whole bunch of stuff that really didn't seem related to the story or move the plot forward at all. It was just like they were kind of messing around, and then we get back to the other stuff.
It's almost like, look, here's an Enterprise chapter. Remember, they're still in this universe.
Exactly. They're out there somewhere, and we're going to bring them in, but, you know, let's take a peek and see what they're doing, having absolutely nothing to do with what's supposed to be going on.
Now, one thing I did find interesting is it wasn't on the Enterprise side, but they did bring back Cyrano Jones and the Tribbles at the end of the book.
Yeah, that was a cool nod to the original series character. And There's a certain point where I was wondering if this person even watched the Star Trek series, but when he kind of dives into like stuff that you're familiar with from the show, besides the Klingons, it seems quite clear that this person actually was very familiar with Star Trek.
And since the story takes place, starts out, and is focused around Sherman's planet and the quadra, it's important to have him show up, I guess, or neat, just neat to have him show up.
Yeah, just as long as they keep the tribbles off the planet, I think we're in good shape. So what did you guys think of Gene Cherney, who actually seemed to be, along with Kang and a couple of the other Klingon characters, seemed to be the central focus of this whole thing?
She was a weird character. The book would have almost been more interesting if it had been one of the cast member, one of the characters you're familiar from the show. But like something like Dwellers in the Crucible, they bring this person kind of out of nowheres, and the entire book focuses on this person you don't actually know. The only benefit is at least you're familiar with who Kang is, but you don't even spend a lot of time with him. You spend time with Klingons who might have been in the show and maybe are nods to names that he said during the episode, but it's nobody that I really recognize. But it's just, it was a very odd choice, but I guess they didn't want it. There's kind of a rapey vibe for a bit with her relationship with Kang, so maybe that's why they didn't want to use a character we're familiar with.
By the same token, this is exactly what a Mary Sue character is. She comes in for one story, does all the stuff she's going to do. She's the main focus of the story. She won't appear in any other story.
Yeah, and she goes back and forth. You know, at one moment, she's very strong, you know, and she's some kind of a knife thrower. She's a really good scientist. She understands genetics and starts to make this new strain of Quadro Triticale to plant that grows faster and yields more. And then all of a sudden, she turns into this subservient person to Kang. And it's just strange, the back and forth with her. I had a real tough time getting a reading on whether she was a strong character or a weak character. It was very difficult.
If this book had been a lot easier to read than what it is, we could probably have justified a lot of what you just said, Jim, in the fact that she has a mental block on her memories. And a lot of the traits that she's got, like the knife throwing, she doesn't really remember fully where it comes from. She just knows she can do it.
See, that part confused me. Does this mean she wasn't actually a scientist and she was actually sort of security officer who became a scientist?
I think it comes out at the end that she's an intelligence officer.
And that part is kind of weird. So do they have the ability to create these, turn these intelligence officers into specialists in different fields of science? That the implications of that, if that's what they're capable of, seem huge.
Well, see, I think that's a part of the problem here. You've got Spock doing a mind merging with her, segmenting her mind off to allow her to accomplish it. And then towards the end of the book, he can do a mind meld to talk to her over light years.
Yeah, and it only gets broken because of the... Oh, geez. I'm sorry. I woke up pretty early to finish this book. I was like 80 pages out this morning because I had such a hard time sitting down and reading it.
It took you that long to get through it. Yes, I can understand that.
And you know, when you said you fell asleep like every 10 pages, I was probably about 80 pages and I go, oh, this book isn't that bad. But then like immediately after that, it just took a downhill slide.
Yeah, there were some moments of brilliance in this book that all of a sudden I would be reading along and it's like, okay, here we go. This is going to get better. And then it just kind of dies again. So I can certainly understand and sympathize with the fact. Only the only difference is I read this book just as quickly as I possibly could, just so I could get through it.
And the really weird part about this book, I actually thought when they said she was a sleeper agent, she was going to turn out to be that Romulan that Chekhov randomly had a infatuation with halfway through the book for like 10 pages. Because she just kind of comes out of nowhere and leaves, and then she's talking about this mental block, and it turns out she was a sleeper agent. I'm like, oh, she's a Romulan. That makes sense. No, wait, she's not. That part was still pointless.
That was a chapter they threw in because this book isn't long enough. Give us some more words.
I'd gladly take a shorter book and a better book, but...
A tighter book. A shorter, tighter book would have been wonderful.
Uh-huh. Yeah, anyway, so... We'll have to, I guess, conclude that Jean Cherney is somewhat of an enigma, and as a main character, really didn't, at least to me, wasn't somebody I really cared that much about because I never really got to know her.
No, you don't even know if you found out who she was because she was a sleeper agent. She could have been somebody completely different.
You know something else, and you mentioned it earlier about Spock and the mind meld thing. You know, I remember from the original series that Spock was hesitant to do mind melds because it was a deeply personal kind of a thing. And so, but it just seems like in whenever Spock is around, it's just like, okay, go mind meld with this person. You don't know who they are. You don't care about them and all this stuff. Just go do it. And it doesn't seem to be anything that is special or something that Spock would want to protect. And then the, as you say, John, over the light years maintaining a connection, the only other time we've seen that is during Discovery.
And that's only because Michael Burnham and Sarok had that father-daughter connection.
So familial ties will actually... keep that subconscious connection then?
I guess in stressful enough conditions, but I think, again, that was the first time they've introduced that type of concept was in Discovery.
And you know what's the really infuriating part about this character too? Is that they kept on saying that things didn't go according to plan because Kang picked her up instead of Cole. What was the plan if Koloff was supposed to pick her up? Because it seemed like the plan went better with Kang picking her up.
And who knew that Kang was the heir apparent to the Emperor?
Yeah, that was out of left field. And well, and then Koloth, of course, they had to mention Koloth because that was, of course, King's or Kirk's nemesis on K7. So, of course, he had to be mentioned to tie in to the show Trouble with Tribbles in the original series.
Well, it does make sense that his ship is the ship that patrols that sector.
I'm not disagreeing with that. It doesn't make sense. He should have been the one to pick her up. I don't understand how the plan would have changed or been better if he picked him up, because they kept on saying that it was like an inconvenience that he picked her up. But if anything, it was better that Kang picked her up because he had the political backing to actually get her to help the Klingon Empire like they wanted her to anyways. What was Koloff going to do?
Make it a shorter, tighter novel.
Well, Kang is also a much stronger character than Koloth was in the original series. I mean, Koloth was duped, first of all. Secondly, he just didn't seem to be very assertive. Being assertive came along in Deep Space Nine, but Koloth was a very weak character in the original series. At least I think he was.
And then on top of that, they put her there because they think there's going to be a raid. The Klingons didn't even show up because there was a raid. There was an earthquake, and she happened to be the only person who survived. And then on top of that, somebody else shows up. Like, and then I was thinking, okay, maybe they caused the earthquake and faked all that. No, it was just an earthquake that randomly happened that Kang showed up to. Like, there's so many weird things that apparently threw this mission off course, but it worked out better in the end.
Yep.
Okay. Let's move along and talk about our Klingon characters. I think Kang in this one had moments of what I thought he should be, and then moments of what just seemed like, I mean, he didn't even seem like a Klingon.
In moments of plot convenience.
Yeah, I have to agree. There was times that Kang was Kang, and there was times that Kang was a background character to just keep the story moving.
So what was up with him and the relationship with his wife, Mara?
It looked like Mara developed a relationship with the Federation during the incident of the Day of the Dove. And she wanted to reach out to the Federation and form an alliance. He did not, as being heir apparent to the Emperor, he did not want this to happen. So they just kind of split up so they wouldn't have the friction that goes along with a marriage of that type. Remember, at this point, Kang doesn't find out about his son till the very end of the novel.
I was kind of confused by their whole separation game back together, because it's like they put a lot of emphasis on it just for in between chapters, like this weird revolution that Mara was trying to lead, a pro-Federation movement, happens off page. Like, they're building up to all this tension between Federation movement, and then she's like, yeah, everything went off without a hitch.
Yeah, I have a tough time with reading these older books after knowing what I know now, and not projecting back and saying that just isn't right. And I think that's a fault that I have. But Mara's relationship with the Federation would have begun when apparently Chekhov was going to try to rape her in Day of the Dove, and Kirk came along and put a stop to that, letting her know that, you know, she was afraid she was going to be taken prisoner, she was going to be tortured, she was going to be hurt, and Kirk put all that to rest. And I don't think that would be quite enough to make a Klingon matriarch like Mara would be into someone who's just ready to sit down and have peace talks with the Federation.
And even if she was all right with that, the weird part is that she goes back to Kang. Like, to me, I thought it was going to turn out that she was, I thought she was in love with Kirk, and that's what the real issue was. And he was projecting this pro-Federation agenda on her because she's actually just in love with Kirk and doesn't want to be with him anymore. But then it just turned out it was this pro-Federation. It's like everything that should have been a little bit more convoluted was extremely straightforward, and the stuff that should have been straightforward was just extremely convoluted and didn't even make sense.
And that brings to mind Kang's relationship with Jean. You know, you mean Mara was just okay with this, him messing around with her? I don't recall ever seeing where Klingons can be polygamists.
If that's the universe that, in fact, that's actually the one thing I'm actually kind of okay with this book, is they set up the setup of them having polygamous marriages, because they actually kind of set up that each planet kind of has their own customs or different ways. Because when I went to this book, I was kind of like, didn't Kang say that females are treated as equals? And as you got farther onto the book, you realize different planets had different customs, and not every Klingon planet was necessarily the same. I was fine with the polygamous thing. It was weird and convenient for plot contrivances, but to me, that is like the least of all the issues in the book.
If you've got a culture where you have marriages of political convenience, and I think we see here that Kang and Mara are a marriage of two houses, two planets, trying to come together for political convenience. Having the ability to have multiple consorts allows you to have other connections to other houses, to other groups, and allows you to build a stronger and stronger community. But of course, I'm postulating that on political strategy and having nothing to do with what's actually in the book.
Yeah, because there was no reason for him to really take this Jean person on as a consort. Like, all you had to do is go, yeah, she's literally the only person who can save us from famine. I'm sure the Klingons would have tolerated her until they got what they needed. She didn't have to be Kang's consort.
Well, that, and she's human. So, you know, if Kang has her as a consort, what is the advantage to him for this?
You're forgetting. Jean is really named Mary Sue.
Okay, I'll buy that. We had other Klingon characters, which I have a real tough time. Airnath, is one, and he and Gene formed a
fall in love.
Well, yeah, kind of, but they form, I was going to say, they form a relationship that is mutually beneficial. However, it's really weird now, okay, because Airnath was more than ready to become subservient to her because of her relationship with Kang. You want to talk about a very weak Klingon character. This guy was one of them.
But remember, she was bonded to Gene, not bonded as in sexual relationship bonding, bonded as in servant bonding.
Yeah, but that whole thing too, like after a while, I thought maybe because this did have a romance novel feel that the two of them were going to develop feelings for them, and that would be the big hitch towards the third act. But that wasn't even it. Just he really had no feelings for one way or the other. It just turned out he was more loyal to Mara instead of Kang.
To me, their relationship seemed more like, oh, I would say brother and sister, that they would help each other out when it was needed.
It's hard to say. I thought there was towards the end, it was a matter of they were trying to choose as what direction the two of them were going to go rather than take off separately at the end.
Yeah, I never expected those two to have a romantic relationship whatsoever, not from what their relationship was based on or the way they behaved toward each other. It was more or less, you know, they would kind of take care of each other more than anything else. What about Tyrax? I think I'm saying that right. And then Kalex.
And aren't they twin brothers?
Yeah, something weird like that.
So, you know, these characters are just not memorable to me whatsoever. What was their significance?
We need somebody in there to stalk Jean and terrorize her.
Yeah, he was just such a pointless character. Like, and if his coming back ended up being her downfall, okay, that would have made sense, but it wasn't even her downfall. It ended up working out in her favor.
See, I read this book 2 weeks ago. I finished it 2 weeks ago, and I don't even remember them, except for vaguely, that they did not like Gene. They did not like Kang's relationship with Gene, and they wanted her out of the way for whatever reason.
Just kind of your cardboard bad guys.
Stock characters, yeah. And then one person that figured into this quite a bit, into this story, was Athelnor. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but Kang and Mara's son, which he didn't even really find out about till the end of the book.
Of course, he wasn't in until like 2/3 or 3/4 of the way to the book when Mara decided that she wanted him to study under the Federation.
The idea of this woman having to smuggle this kid across as leverage against the future emperor, yeah, it's an interesting idea, but it wasn't even that well executed, because then everything went to plan, and everything on Mars End went according to plan anyways, and the kid seemed redundant at that point.
Well, it just seemed like everything, there were so many ideas thrown into this that even the what to me at least turned out to be the main point of the book, which is the Klingon Empire is having a rough time feeding themselves, so they need something to help them get food production up to keep from starving. Gene has this strain of Quadra Triticale that grows quickly and has a high yield,
and is resistant to the virus that has wiped out the Klingon crops.
Yes, and then, you know, that, what seems to me should be the point of the entire book, really takes a background to some of the political maneuvering that's going on in the last third of this book.
Because you saw what happened in Star Trek VI when the Klingons lost their power production, and how that focused everything to drive the plot to one of the more successful Star Trek movies.
Well, the Praxis blowing up was the vehicle to bring the Klingons and the humans together in a conflict. So, I'm not seeing if what I'm not seeing, I guess, is the follow up of the reason for the Quadratriticale. I'm just not seeing anything from resulting from that. It just seems to be a disconnected idea. Okay, here's what's going to happen. We're going to feed the Klingons, and boom, we got all this other weird stuff happening.
And I think the problem with that, the reason you're saying that, is as soon as she gets the crop stabilized on a particular planet, Kang is whisking her away to another planet.
It would have been interesting if there had been like an ideology thing where some of the planets wouldn't accept the crops because it would have been better to die than to take the Federation aid, which was part of the reason why the Federation put her in as a double agent to begin with, like that they knew they wouldn't accept the help, so they're going to trick them into accepting the help. But all this was supposed to lead towards peace talks, and I still don't get why that ended up having nothing to do with them showing up the peace talks, because they had a hostage, which was pointless anyways.
It's not a matter, though, in the way they've presented it, it's not a matter of the Klingons accepting help from the Federation. They went in and they took what they needed and they won the day to use this crop as they needed to use this crop. It wasn't a help thing.
But that's why they set up them being able to raid this planet, was because they knew the Klingons wouldn't accept the help. So they planted her there so that they could take her, and it would seem like they took it, but it would have been an interesting story if the Klingons, it might have made the story more interesting if planets didn't want to accept the human crops anyways, because they felt it was like, I don't know, dishonorable or some bullshit like that, and they should just be invading the Federation and enslaving them or something. So it's not an interesting plot, is what it gets down to, I guess.
And I think if she had kept focused on the famine and not diverged at the end to have this kid needing to go to the Federation for training, we might have seen that as, okay, this is what we've invested our time in. This is the story we've been reading. Now this is the conclusion that we're going to get.
Like if they'd stretched this out over the book, like all these different storylines over 10 books, and devoted like a little bit more time to each one, in the end, the thing that had to make the Federation peace talks happen was the kid. Okay, whatever. But it's all happening in one book. It's like an entire season of interweaving plot lines in one book.
Without knowing where it's going.
Or where it went, because the book just kind of ends and you have no idea what happened.
Yeah, it definitely meanders around all over the place. Let's move on to Cyrano Jones.
The parts with him were delightful. I thought they were funny. He captured the character.
It was interesting. Going back and reading that chapter on the Romulans today, I see in the chapter where they set up that Spock was going to link up with Cyrano Jones to go pull Jean out of the situation that she's in and clear up her mind so she knows what's going on.
I didn't even pick that up.
Wake up!
Well, I guess I would have to agree with you, Javon. The Cyrano Jones parts were probably some of the best in the book. They were interesting. They were kind of funny. He, of course, was keeping the Tribbles under control because Klingons don't like Tribbles and vice versa. But he had a...
And the Federation has him under indictment if he doesn't.
Yeah, and he had a different pet, it seemed, if I recall correctly.
The only issue I have with his part is that they kind of made up this whole... And it seems fairly... It didn't feel like very organic to that part of the story. It was just like, oh, he's in trouble again, so now he's busy, so now we have an excuse not to give him over to the Klingon Empire, where it's just he's a Federation citizen and they'll deal with him. And that should have been part of negotiations. How are we going to deal with when one of our citizens commit a crime against your empire or our Federation? Rather, it just kind of gets swept under the rug. Oh, we already have him doing something.
But I think that would be better served in a different book. This one already has too many things going on and is why it's so confusing.
Yeah, it's hard to pick out the main point. Any places we want to discuss in this podcast?
I was fairly interested when they, because they did it a lot in the book, they stopped and they kind of explained the cultures of each of the different Klingon planets. And I knowing what I know, like knowing about the TNG era, Enterprise era, and Discovery era and all that, that stuff, I'm fine being able to be detach myself from all that and just accept this for based off of the TNG and the TAS era. And I was interested in how the Klingon Empire was portrayed, that isn't just one cookie-cutter culture. Each planet has its own customs and their own belief. And like I said, I thought it was strange that a lot of them had a very negative view of women until you found out that the planets they came from, women aren't as considered as equals as whatever planet that apparently Kang and Mara came from, for Kang the to treat her like an equal, like the rest of his men.
And that could be a thing that we saw from Next Generation on, where the Klingon women were equal to the men in just about everything.
Well, and but then there is Martok, and the impression that I get from what Klingons later on have it is it's more of a matriarchal society, while the male Klingon has his name on the house. It is his house. Everything is his possession. The female runs the household, including the person who owns the house.
Wasn't there something strange about the line of succession for the emperor in this story?
Yeah, he's like the nephew of the emperor, and it has something to do with the eldest son and the thrall or something like that.
Or I thought it ran through a woman somehow.
Oh yeah, maybe it ran through the oldest female, the oldest female son or something like that.
They didn't go into it enough to really get you a grasp of court politics, but it's confusing.
And the whole am I even saying that right? Thrawd thing was confusing too, because then they're talking about how the son was supposed to go with the uncle so that he could be the emperor of another planet. So there's like multiple emperors, and that makes up the council or something like that.
I don't know. I couldn't see any clear cut explanation to the reins of power in this particular story. We heard about the emperor, but we never heard of Knos or Klingza or any capital planet to the Klingon Empire.
Well, I thought the planet Kang was from was supposed to be the, or he was going to inherit, was supposed to be the capital of the Klingon Empire.
But that sure throws a wrench into the works of what we know about Klingons.
It is, yeah. As far as Klingon culture is concerned, I put very, very little value in this book.
It's just so bloody confusing.
T'Harn. Yeah, and the person who's in charge of that planet is referred to as the Emperor of the Ancient Court of Klingonese.
Okay, so T'Harn is the capital of the Klingon Empire then?
I'm assuming so, based off of this book. They never said in the series, so I just kind of go with it each book.
Well, I think we've seen in a few other books, they refer to the planet of the capital planet of the Klingons as Klingza or something like that. Klinza, Zhai, can't remember exactly.
Yeah, the capital definitely moves around a lot in the Klingon Empire, apparently.
Now, one thing I was thinking of, in Discovery, they make reference in the first episode that they haven't been to their homeworld in like 100 years or something like that, the 24 houses. I wonder if because of that, the Klingon homeworld maybe moved locations after all the main houses abandoned it. So another planet became the head planet of the Empire because of that.
Any theory as good as another right now.
So are there any places, things, adventures that we would want to discuss here?
We talked about planets, and you say that they gave you a sense of their culture and a sense of the planet. It seemed to me like every planet Gene went to was just like any other planet, but that could be because she was focused on the farmlands of whatever planet she was sent to. What do you guys think?
I think perhaps, there was no real difference because they were focusing on more on Jean trying to get food production up and going on each planet.
Well, I get the impression that the author was trying to flesh out the cultures. It'd been interesting if just one of the three planets actually been pro-Federation. Like it would have added a little bit of diversity to the Klingon culture a little bit more, but you're right. They did come off as just a bunch of jerks every time she showed up.
Now, what I did find interesting and memorable was the fact that you had a spaceport depicted in one of the scenes as they're trying to get off the final planet and get back to Federation space. And I don't think we've seen this before in Star Trek or in any of the books that we've covered, where you've got civilians boarding crafts and lifting off the planet. It's always been a transporter thing up till now. And the spaceport is depicted as a hub of activity with lots of people milling in it.
Yeah, and there were aliens other than Klingons, like there's Spock there as a Vulcan. And what we find out later on in TNG that the Raman anatomy is apparently more compatible with Klingon somehow, whatever. So it's weird that that scanner was able to pick out human, but it didn't like go haywire because apparently there were other alien races there.
Well, based on later books that I've read, the Klingon Empire is built by conquering a planet and assimilating the race that's on that planet into the Klingon Empire, the way the Romans conquered a city-state and assimilated its citizens into the Roman Empire. So their spaceports should have lots of different alien races.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't realize that that's the way it was in the Prime Universe, because I've been reading a lot of the IDW of the Calvin Universe, and they make reference, and I think it's called Manifest Destiny, that the Klingon Empire usually goes in and kills everybody, then establishes their own outpost and stuff. And it was considered unhonorable to enslave a race and try to raise them under Klingon rule so that they'll support them.
In later books that involve Klingons, I got a different impression of how things work with the Klingons. Go in, yes, they conquer the planet and they take care of business and get rid of any kind of resistance that there might be. And then the population of the planet becomes servants to the Empire, not necessarily slaves, but more like indentured servants, where they're tolerated a lot more, and it's less of a slavery situation than more of a place for the Klingons to put down where they need to be.
Well, I think we see in the Gorkon series of books, it's even less. They start out as servants, as indentured servants or whatever, and they're working towards becoming basic citizens of the Klingon Empire. But it's still the original Klingons that are going to form the basis for the defense force for the Klingon Empire.
Okay, same thing I said, but you said it a lot better. Now, we've talked a lot about this book so far. How about favorite points of plot? I think we may have covered a few of those, but are there any here that kind of stand out?
I guess my favorite part would be when Spock and Cero Jones show up. Just kind of that part of it is my favorite part. Other than that, the rest of it is just kind of a confusing mess.
And I think a lot of that too is Spock and Cyrano Jones show up after a particularly long period of Gene negotiating with Mara to get the kid off the planet. So we spent a lot of time with the Klingons and Gene, and now we get some Federation people again.
Yeah, during the negotiations, which kind of, to me, seemed to make the most sense, that we have now Kang negotiating with the Federation to try to bring things together, which of course results on cooperation on Sherman's planet. Now, do I have that right, or have I completely missed the mark?
It's hard to remember. I think I was falling asleep.
Towards the end of the book, the Klingons and the Federation kind of come together for negotiations, and a lot of things are revealed and stuff like that. And I figured since you just finished the book this morning, perhaps you can fill us in on where that fits into the whole picture.
Oh, wow. So basically the end, it's kind of trying to tie this hot mess all together with this negotiations where they go back to the planet that where it all started, Sherman's planet. It turned out the Klingons were ignoring the Organians, and the Organians actually granted the request, which is really weird that they didn't have the ability to, like, I guess the Organians will know if they read their mail or something weird like that. I don't know, which starts off the negotiations. And then the ending was really confusing to me because it just kind of ends at one point, just out of nowhere's. I guess Kirk accidentally said the activation word that activated Jean's mental block, and she remembered who she was. And for some weird reason, they had to explain this to further the plot, which it really, if she just kept her mouth shut, I think it wouldn't have changed anything. And then Kang gets to meet his son after the negotiations, which don't seem like there were really much was going on there other than they're agreeing not to be dicks to each other, which they couldn't anyways because of the Organia Accords, which made the whole negotiations actually really pointless now that I think about it. And it ends with Kang de-thralling her and making her like a cousin or something like that, and she could go back to the Federation, and then it just kind of ends. And you don't know what's going on, if this will go anywhere.
You mentioned the Organians, and I kind of forgotten about that, but somehow the Organians are now involved between the Federation and the Romulans because the Enterprise takes the Romulan survivor of the destroyed ship in that inserted chapter to the Organians to have them take her back to Romulus.
And, you know, the Organians, through the last few books that we have read, have been, just rendered down to being more like a meddlesome thing rather than what they said in the episode was, you go to war and you will be destroyed, which is cut and dried, and the Organians don't care beyond that what they do to each other. And it just seems like they're way more involved here than they should be.
And then the epilogue is like 2 pages of McCoy giving Spock a gift from Jones. And it's just, and you don't even know how Spock really reacts because it literally ends at the end of a page. And I flip and I'm like, wait, that's it? There's nothing else?
So yeah, all the way around, it's not a great book.
Needs massive editing.
Oh, yeah. So let's move on. Closing thoughts. Jorn, you go first with this.
Wait a minute. I got to wake up. I was looking at the book again. Which I think probably is the biggest point here in closing thoughts. This was not a well-scripted, well-thought-out, well-plotted story. It's confusing in where it's going. It's muddled in where it's going. We've seen at least one chapter that looks like it was just inserted and has absolutely no point whatsoever to the plot rolling forward. And the end seems so abrupt that you almost can't take it at face value. It just doesn't make sense. It's one of those books that you want to keep on your nightstand if you're having trouble sleeping at night.
So what you're saying is it's more like Pawns and Somonex.
Better than Ambien.
Does anybody even really remember what Somonex is? I don't know. And Javon, how about your closing thoughts?
I did not like this book, as I originally said. I'd probably give it a 1 out of 5 at best. I think I previously said that I put Time Trap over top of... I put this between Time Trap and How Much for Just the World in regards to what we've read so far. But like How Much for Just the Planet, I'd still say this isn't the worst Star Trek book I've read. But it gives a pretty good go at it. It's just about as pointless, and it has a lot of, like, it's like, well, that would have been interesting to read, but you don't, or, and it doesn't go anywhere. So not just one pointless chapter. I found most chapters on the Sherman Planet were fairly pointless. Oh, I really don't have much to say about this book.
I thought this book was convoluted as hell. I didn't really understand what was going on a great deal of the time. I thought there were a lot of good ideas and a lot of good threads that would have made good stories, but it was way too unfocused as it was for me to enjoy. I felt that the Klingons were not very Klingon. I don't know. I would have to rate this book a 2 out of 5 because I kind of enjoyed it. And so I enjoyed some of the Enterprise things. I'm going to give it a 2 because I guess I'll get specific and say because the Enterprise crew were what they should be. They were well written. One thing that really distracted me in this book is a lot, and I mean a lot of typos, at least in the Kindle edition. Spock came out several times as Speck with an E instead of an O. There were other things that were misspelled, some real grammar things that weren't too good. So yeah, 2 out of 5.
I'd have to go with a 1 out of 5, like Javon was saying. And that must be a Kindle thing, Jim, because I don't remember seeing that many typos in this one, and I usually stumble over every single one.
Yeah, you know what's the really weird part is I went to download the Kindle version of this, and I couldn't get it, so I had to stick with the book version.
Well, I had no problem downloading it at all. So, Javon, you say we got some feedback already on this. You want to take us through that, please?
Yes, we got a long one and a short one. Kathy, who had actually originally recommended this book, said this is a good Klingon book. I'm going to have to disagree with that, but yeah.
Is that all she said? She didn't defend it?
No, I believe we're having them back on next month for the Romulan Way. I guess we could always ask her.
Oh, that cat. That, okay.
Are you sure we want to prolong that into our next episode?
I really don't. We've got a lot to talk about when we get to the Romulan Way, because there are sections of that book that are very, very dense.
And this one's from Adrian. This is a long one, so hold on. So here's a synopsis. An English noblewoman is kidnapped by a lusty pirate, and she spends the entire book saying, "No, no, I will never love you." All the while, a lusty pirate is hovering nearby with a villainous grin saying, "Yes, you will, my sweet." Oh, wait, that was a Harlequin romance book I read for English class. Here's the real synopsis. A high-ranking Federation scientist is kidnapped by a lusty Klingon, and she spends the entire book saying, "No, no, I will never love you." All the while, the lusty Klingon is hovering nearby with a villainous grin saying, "Yes, you will, my sweet." Yeah, that's more like it. I'm sure anyone reading this review is saying, this is a Star Trek book. Where's Captain Kirk and company? No need to fear, I will tell you. Well, the high-ranking Federation scientist with top-secret project, only she has the keys to, no less, is in the vile clutches of a lusty Klingon. Kirk and friends are busying themselves, singing songs, and playing chess while Chekhov finds himself in the embrace of a lusty Romulan. For those who haven't figured it out by now, this is a painful read, and no, I couldn't finish it. It just hurt. This book is less like a Star Trek book and more like a Harlequin romance I was forced to read for class. Worse yet, there was a lot of potential for a really good story. The Federation scientist was kidnapped by the Klingons because of her work in agriculture bioengineering, in the belief that she would help to stop a famine that was sweeping several Klingon planets. Now, that is a cool idea. Coupled with some good world-building ideas the author threw in, this could have been a really great book. Instead, the excitement and drama that such a plot should create was almost absent as our doormat-like protagonist spends the book, or at least the part I was able to get through, as far away and oblivious as can be from the tense political and social atmosphere on the Klingon planet she was on. Instead, we were treated to the high drama of her trying to resist General Kang's lusty Klingon charms. The world building was somewhat more interesting, but again, the potential falls flat since it was more like a Wikipedia-style info dump than an engaging exploration of Klingon world. Groan. And yeah, Kirk and company were in this as well. No, really, they were. This is a good book if you're interested in seeing on how not to write, but otherwise, if it's excitement and drama you're looking for, stick to the Wikipedia article. Don't waste your time on this one.
I think that's what we just said.
I was just going to say, if you had read that at the beginning of this podcast, it would have been all over then, because that is right on target and well-written and hilarious. But I kind of like the pirate idea at the beginning.
Yeah, he went with pirates, and I'm using Mary Sue example. So, yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, when you sent me the review, at first I was like, a pirate? Then I read a little bit farther. I was like, oh, okay, I get it now.
But he's right on the mark, exactly the way this author wasn't.
Precisely.
And that's from Adrian. He usually chimes in every month or something. I've actually asked him for some. I said, next time you're going to have to actually give us some reading suggestions.
It was brilliant. Interjecting a quick note here for the listeners that wish to read along for our next book selection. We were originally scheduled to read The Romulan Way, Rianzu Book 2 by Diane Duane. However, due to scheduling conflicts, our next read will be Star Trek The Next Generation, War Drums by John Von Holt, and we will be reviewing The Romulan Way on the show after that. All right, so Javon, tell us, how do people get in touch with us? Where do they find us?
If they want to email us, they can email us at podcast@keg.org. They can find all of the our catalog, back catalog of podcasts, not only the Bound by Honor, but all the regular Keg podcast episodes on keg.org/podcasts. They can find us on iTunes and Google Play. And if you just want to contact us in general, just you can find us at Keg Podcast on either Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, just Keg Podcast. If you type it in somewhere, you'll probably find us there.
Excellent. So that is our episode of Bound by Honor. Say goodnight, gentlemen.
Goodnight, gentlemen.
What he said.
And I am Ja Jim. Join us next time on Bound by Honor. Kapla.
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 You comedian. You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!